This last week, something interesting happened. Playboy made the announcement that it was changing its focus. Did you see that? There would no longer be a centerfold. Now, Hugh Hefner had launched this idea of a sort of semi-pornographic magazine in the 60s to break open this sexually inhibited culture of Christian America. And I was a student, just come over from England during the 60s when this thing was launched. Well, I guess it was earlier than that. It was in the late 50s. So what's happened? Well, what's happened is that Playboy has decided that their message now has become too tame. And their circulation has gone from 8 million to 800,000. Because now pornography is available to everybody at the touch of a button. And they are now revamping their message. Al Mohler made a comment about this. He said, "This signals the fall of an entire civilization and the moral consensus that made that civilization possible." Now, I don't want to be too negative, but, you know, when you read that every second 4,000 pages of pornography are opened in this culture, you realize the massive influence of a perverse kind of sexuality on virtually many, many people. And it drives you back to ask the question, how do you make sense of this time? You know, I go around and people say to me, "Isn't it awful?" But the point is, how do you oppose awful? And I felt that there was a need for myself and maybe for others too to come up with categories that make sense so that we can, with the categories, take on the challenge. I started off with the categories. Oh, I didn't see you all up there. Basically, young people, I think. I started off with Christianity and Gnosticism, but nobody knows what Gnosticism is. My first book was entitled "The Gnostic Empire Strikes Back." A good title, right? And my father-in-law came up with the subtitle, "An Old Heresy for the New Age." Isn't that cute? Anyway, it's been downhill from there on, but that was in 93 when I published that book. I did publish two others because I was changing my focus, and then I started talking about Christianity and paganism. But people don't like the term pagan. And in the South, of course, pagan means the people who are playing golf this morning, rather than being in church, whereas paganism is a much stronger term and people can be offended by that. Another way of talking about the conflict in our time is between theism and monism, but that is so specialized you'd have to stop and explain that before people would understand. Well, I ended up with these two terms, oneism and twoism. Now, if you can count from one to two, you can be a theologian. Now, where do I get this notion of oneism and twoism? I trust it is very biblical. And I took it from what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1:25. You remember that key text? It's a most revolutionary text where he says that there are only two ways to be a human being in this world. Isn't that wonderful? Things are simple. You've heard from your high school or university that there are 365 different ways to approach God. The Apostle Paul says there are only two, and one doesn't get you there. What does he say? He says you either worship the creation or you worship the Creator who is blessed forever. Now, you have 1,000 different ways of worshiping the Creator. The creation, spiritual ways, even materialistic, atheistic ways, but you're still focused only on the creation, and that is the only reality. And so if it is, if you have to worship, that's what you will worship. And if there's only the creation, then everything about the creation is the same, ultimately. It's all creational material. And so I came up with the word oneism. All is one. Everything is of the same nature. Everything, of course, therefore, if you need to do it, can be worshipped. So that's why you have tree huggers. Why worship a tree, right? Well, because ultimately you're worshipping the reality of nature behind the tree. An atheist doesn't think he's worshipping, but he's defining the world only in his terms, and in that sense, he's worshipping himself. So it also is a oneist perspective. Now, oneism, of course, makes sense when you talk about the second term that we need to employ, and that is twoism, which is implied with what Paul says when he says, or the worship of the Creator who is blessed forever. My dear friend Rick is going to preach to you today on Genesis 1:1. Wonderful text. And you know, that was a revolutionary announcement of an idea that was almost unknown in the ancient pagan world, that there's such a thing as a God separate from the creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Everything else following that is created. I said to Rick in his office just now, Genesis 1:1 is the programmatic statement. Everything else in the Bible is just commentary. Now, the implication of that is, of course, that there are two kinds of beings in reality, not just one, the created world or the physical world or the physical cosmos. There are two kinds of being. The Creator, who is uncreated, and everything else which is created. That makes a fundamental distinction. Anyone here not had a birthday? Put your hand up and I'll give you a free book. I knew my book selection was safe. Because we all have a beginning. We're all created. God has never been created. And somehow our spirituality, our understanding of the world, has to take seriously into account that fundamental fact. And I suggest to you that those two ways, ultimately the only two ways you can look at anything, you can either look at things from a oneist perspective, where we're basically celebrating the notion that all is one, or we're celebrating the idea that there is a God separate from us who made the world. And the Apostle Paul says that so clearly. And I think that we understand the clarity of that just by noticing it. But a British theologian by the name of Colin Gunton, who just died a few years ago, said this: there are probably, ultimately, only two possible answers to the question of origins. Either that the universe is the result of a creation by a free personal agency, or that in some way or other it creates itself. These are the only two possibilities. Think about it. The world is either created by a personal God, or in some weird, mysterious way it creates itself. And that second way is paganism. It's the belief that the world can create itself in some miraculous way. If that was the case, I'd want to worship nature, wouldn't you? It's an incredible gift to be able to create yourself and to produce what we see today. This way of understanding the world, though, divided into these two kinds of being, is classic down the ages in theology. Even Alexis de Tocqueville made this statement. I just lost it. Anyway, he says that man is constantly tempted to bring God and to include in the rest of nature with us, which is precisely what paganism is. It's the worship of nature. All is one. I would like to look at how this kind of thinking has become endemic to our present culture in ways that people don't see. And I want you to see it so that you can indeed make some sense of it for yourself and for the witness of the church. Especially are we seeing this in sexuality, as a matter of fact. This is the place where I believe we have to locate our deep thinking about the issues of sexuality in our time. And I would just warn you that as you raise the question of sexuality, there are certain pitfalls. We must realize that we're dealing with deeply hurt people, for instance. Many homosexuals have been abused from childhood. And we just can't slap them in the face and say God hates facts. It's much more complicated than that. And so we must avoid moralism. You know, if only you were like me. Well, of course, we know when we look into our heart that we're all sinners. And we can never take a moralistic. That's not to say we don't talk about morality, but moralism. Namely that I'm good, we are good, and you're not. And so there are pitfalls. One of the things, though, that is happening in our time is an over-expression of sentimentalism by many people in the evangelical church. Where touched by the suffering of homosexuals have sort of collapsed into accepting the whole lifestyle. And I would argue that we have to avoid moralism, sentimentalism, traditionalism, namely that's the way we've always done it, or even just citing the Bible texts, of which there are a number that clearly bring a strong disavowal of homosexuality. But I believe our witness must go way beyond simply showing the negative texts. So, how can we do it? What can we do? All right, I come back then to the subject I was going to raise before this other one came into my mind, and I felt like I had to say what I just said. And that is, how are we seeing this one-est-two-est struggle in our time? As a matter of fact, how are we seeing the rise of a one-est worldview, a pagan worldview, that puts only the truth of nature as the reference point? Anybody heard the phrase, the denial of the binary? Anybody? One guy shaking his head. This is good. You're reading the right stuff. Two guys. Two guys with black robes. Though I'm suspicious of people with black robes. After June 26th. The phrase, the denial of the binary, is starting to appear, and I want you to be aware of it. After June 26th and the decision of those five black-robed judges, I read an article in the Huffington Times by a teacher of four-year-olds. And this is what she said. I worked to create a classroom environment where differing points of view, men marrying men, women marrying women, can be addressed. And through conversation, we can model non-judgmental behavior and challenge binary thinking. Challenge binary thinking. This is for four-year-olds. Now, you see, this is where this one-ism is coming into our world in an apparently very innocuous kind of way. Because nobody knows the meaning of binary and non-binary. And yet, you know what binary means. It means two. So non-binary thinking, then, is to think without making distinctions, without making judgments about male or female, right and wrong, good and evil. We're moving into this time where people want to, as the classic pagans have said down the years, join the opposites. You will come across that phrase as well, joining the opposites. And I see this phrase, the binary, in other places. Dartmouth College seeks to provide a living environment, one not limited by the traditional gender binary. Dartmouth was founded as a mission school for the American Indians. Oberlin College, founded by two Presbyterian ministers headed by Charles Finney, says they are committed to finding a space that defies the binary in our society. So in the academic world, this term binary is very much in evidence, especially as it applies to sexuality. We are living in a time that wants to eliminate even the idea of binary. I read 2 days ago a student at Cambridge University in Great Britain who calls herself a non-binary trans, if you can figure that out. But of course, the whole goal really is to eliminate distinction in the secular realm. Do you notice that? Are you seeing that? The confusion of sexes. Well, I do think that we need to be aware of where this is happening, and it's happening in other places than the sexual. But that's where the battle is joined right now. And it's joined in a way that can almost shock you. A statement by Jeremy Rifkin, a futurist and advisor to the European Common Market, says this: if you didn't think there was a spiritual war raging around us, we no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existing cosmic rules. It is our creation now. We make the rules. We establish the parameters of reality. We create the world, and because we do, we no longer feel beholden to outside forces. See the elimination of the God of the outside. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we are now the architects of the universe. We are responsible for nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. What a statement. What an announcement of a worldview that is making its way into our world with such power. I see the binary being attacked in the area of theology, what we believe about God. An author who writes a very controversial kind of theology, which is read by the leaders of the emergent movement. Some of you have perhaps heard of that emergent movement. She says this: we need a God defined less in binary terms, praying to God as our mother. I met a black pastor a couple of days ago in Colombia, and he said, what's wrong with mother God? It just sounds nice. Well, I explained to him, and he understood. It is the worship of nature. The goddess is the symbol with her womb of nature. We emerge from that womb. We are part of nature. Therefore, speaking about the worship of the goddess is the worship of nature. And so it's the very opposite of what the scripture says. So here's what's being proposed to people on the fringes of evangelicalism today. We need a God defined less in binary terms, praying to God as our mother. And you come across this in other phrases. I've been seeing the promotion of a non-dual ethic. Non-dual would be the same as non-binary, right? A non-dual ethic means that you cannot insist upon real differences between good and evil. You have to, as the pagans say, join the opposites. Make a relative mess of things, actually. In spirituality, we see this joining of the opposites, this denial of the binary. It's never described as such that way, but I want you to see that this is what's happening. A group proposing meditation to change and remake the planet is a surprising claim. People sitting there cross-legged looking at a wall doesn't sound very revolutionary, right? But according to this group, meditation creates a new kind of human being with values very different from what we know today. The proposal is to flip the values of yesteryear for new ones. What are they? It's filled with a sense of unlimited potential through direct knowing of oneself as divine, when you don't have to play by the old rules. And of course, people are getting involved in this kind of spirituality through meditation, through mindfulness, and through yoga. There are some people that think they can do yoga because it's good physical exercise, and I'm sure it is, but there is a danger in it because its goal is to have you understand that you are the center of the universe. I was reading a book relative to what I've been studying, which was very clarifying to me, called American Veda. Veda is Indian theology thinking, and it was written by Philip Goldberg. And his thesis was that America has become Hindu. And with all the meditation practices and whatnot, he writes this very interesting book. I recommend you reading it, American Veda, Philip Goldberg. And he says that what's happening in the West is that we are all coming to accept this fundamental notion of Hinduism called Advaita. A-D-V-A-I-T-A, Sanskrit term. I'd never seen it before. I read on. You'd be amazed what Advaita means. Not to. That's the specific definition of that term, not to. In other words, it's the very denial of the biblical revelation of Genesis 1:1. The world is not two, it's one. And so this spirituality is focused on teaching people that things are one and there's no such thing as two-ness. So you will hear, and as you read, note, various phrases that are subtly introducing this oneness thinking into our present-day, seemingly normal kind of living. Denial of the binaries, discovering non-dual reality. Oh, by the way, in Fuller Theological Seminary, there is a Roman Catholic priest in love with Buddha who is teaching demon students. And he's teaching non-binary spirituality. See how far this is actually going in our evangelical world. People are seduced by this notion of the non-binary because it gives you the impression you're getting closer to God, you see. Whereas you're actually denying the very person of God as you do that. So, discovering non-dual reality, destroying the dichotomies would be another way. Joining of the opposites, I said, Advaita, unitive consciousness, rejection of dogma for spirituality. Behind that, I'm spiritual, not religious, you see. You have that notion that I put my will together my way. Well, this is what we're seeing, but we're seeing it especially in this debate on sexuality. The destruction of the gender binary, you see, becomes a strategic way of changing the way people think about themselves. I don't think you can simply dismiss sexuality as something we do in our bedroom. It's who we are as human beings. That's why in Genesis 1:27 we read that God created man in his image, male and female. There's something about gender that is part of our very image and how we reflect God himself. So that sexuality, as it's risen in our time as this massive point of the spear, is threatening the way, not just the way people act sexually, but the way they, what did I say? Did I offend anybody? I just figured that. I knew. It's people under conviction. I understand. It's not just people engaging in certain kinds of sexuality that I think we're noticing, really, because that very direction of thinking in sexuality is getting us to think in a non-binary way across the board. That's what I'm suggesting is the great danger of this movement. Someone has recently said that homosexuality is a form of Gnosticism. Remember, Gnosticism, well, why he says that and why I want to emphasize it is I want you to see that sexuality has a religious or spiritual category to it. It's not just what we do in the bedroom. It is, in fact, the embodiment of a particular view of the way the world is put together. That's what sexuality is. It's an embodiment of religious and spiritual truth. So, this particular scholar, a Roman Catholic, says that homosexuality is a form of Gnosticism. You remember the Gnosticism? The Gnostics rejected the body, but felt that the spirit was the most important. And so, they allowed themselves to be guided by their spiritual intuitions. Well, this is what's happening, isn't it? The biological reality of who we are apparently doesn't seem to count anymore. It's who we think we are, who we want to be in our minds that becomes the determining factor. I myself studied Gnosticism at Princeton and wrote half a dissertation on Gnosticism before my advisor abandoned me and I had to change my thesis, but I did read over and over again, actually wrote a book. It's probably my best book. No one's ever read it. It's a shame. Even though I say it myself. Stolen Identity is the book. If you want to get a hold of it, it's comparing the Gnostic views of Jesus with the biblical gospels. Stolen Identity. You can see it on my website, truthexchange.com. Anyway, I've read the Gnostic text many times, and I notice how the Gnostics rejected the objectivity of the flesh, including normal marriage and childbirth. You get phrases like flee maternity, destroy the works of the female. Androgyny is held up as the ultimate spiritual ideal. What is androgyny? It's the joining of male and female in the same human being. Now, that might sound odd, how many people you meet like that, but as a matter of fact, homosexuals as a couple have to play the role of both male and female. And so they are effectively androgynous. It's a form of androgyny where you are both a male and a female. Well, these Gnostics, you see, in rejecting the flesh, the biological reality in the ancient world, became so radical that they rejected the Old Testament. They mocked the God of creation. They said he was an evil God. And ultimately, one text says that the goddess Zoe breathed fire upon Yahweh's face and threw him down into hell. That's where you end up with Gnosticism. You throw the Creator into hell. Is that what we're doing today in America? We're walking all over him anyway. We don't want to have anything to do with the notion of God the Creator. But you can go beyond Gnosticism to what was behind Gnosticism, which is ancient paganism, to get more of a depth of what we're talking about. I did a study entitled Androgyny, the Pagan Sexual Ideal. It's a long article. If you want to read it, it's on my website as well, truthexchange.com. And I followed the work of the one who is considered to be the greatest history of religion scholar, having produced 16 volumes on the history of religion, especially paganism. And this scholar noted that in virtually all pagan religions in time and space, the shaman or the high priest is a homosexual. You can go to the second millennium BC, where the worship of the goddess Ishtar is celebrated with homosexual priests. The worship of Cybele, or Artemis as we call her in the New Testament, also included the worship, service of homosexuals called galloi. Indeed, Augustine in Hippo writes about these homosexual priests in a parade with makeup on and weird clothing and so on, out in the streets. So nothing is new under the sun. When the conquistadores came to South America, they were shocked to see how much homosexuality was employed in the animism of the Aztecs and the Mayans. Of course, well, now I'm reading a book now where they're actually celebrating that and trying to make it return since the conquistadores wiped it out. Well, you see, what's going on here in this role of the spiritual leader is pointing towards the elimination of the opposites, male and female, are completely denied. But it's interesting, you see, that you cannot show that these various cults of across space, the jungles of Africa and the jungles of Borneo, ever had any direct contact with each other, and through time as well. And so one has to ask the question, to what extent does paganism itself, this oneist view of things, actually produce this embodied form as the true meaning of the worship of oneism? It is, in fact, as I'm arguing to you, endemic to a pagan worldview. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that your homosexual friends understand anything about this, nor do you have to make them feel guilty for the whole history of oneism. What they need to hear is something about the history and the meaning of their practice. And so many of them are not aware of that. And I think it's a good idea that we bring that to them. Now, this has been said recently, relatively recently as well. June Singer in 1977 in her book, Androgyny, Towards a New Theory of Sexuality. She was a Gnostic, and she was a Jungian psychologist, and she caught on to Carl Jung's vision of a new humanity. And so already at the cusp of the 60s revolution, she's talking about a new sexuality. And she says this, which is incredible. What lies in store as we move towards the longed-for conjunction of the opposites? Can the human psyche realize its own creative potential through building its own cosmology? In other words, the vision was, can we take these inner experiences that people claim they had in the New Age movement and turn it into a cosmology and sort of applying it over the whole of the culture? And this is what we're seeing today. We're seeing the radical application of this kind of thinking in law, and in particularly in law and in policies throughout our world. This cosmology is working well. It's a oneist cosmology. And this woman actually goes so far, and this is what convinced me that there is a religious aspect to sexuality here. She says this, that the archetype of androgyny appears to us as an innate sense of and witness to the primordial cosmic unity. That is, all is one. That is, it is, and here's the killer, the sacrament of oneism. She calls it a sacrament. And I don't think we can take her words lightly. This is the intention of this movement. Toby Johnson, much more recent fellow gay theorist, says that contemporary gay consciousness represents a new religious paradigm. And of course, a new religious paradigm fits, he says, with interfaith spirituality. So just the way you join the sexes, you join all the religions. So it is a massive cosmology. The homosexual rabbi J. Michelson talks about the fact that sexual minorities transcend dichotomy and enter the zone of the sacred. Another statement, then, you see, of the religious power of transcending the differences and joining what the Bible says should be kept apart. I think I have 7 minutes left, is that right? I want to give you then this vision of a sexual cosmology. Not, as I say, to make your homosexual friends and colleagues and whatnot feel that they're responsible for that. In a certain way they are, but to bring some clarity to them. Now, this really was the introduction to my lecture today. I kid you not. But we won't be able to give the lecture. But I thought I would give you the first part of it because I believe it will help you to take some, to have some distance. Does it work? Does this approach work? Well, I can only tell you one story. I gave this lecture some years ago. And at the end of the lecture, I'm standing on a platform. And this fellow comes towards me, and I'm looking up at him, and I'm on the platform. He was 6 feet 10 inches, and he looked very angry, and I was sure that was the last time I would ever give this lecture. But instead, he thrust a piece of paper into my hand, turned on his heels, and walked out of the building. I never saw him again. Didn't know what had happened to him until I was meeting with a group of students at Vanderbilt, and they asked me about this whole issue and how you can use this information, and I told them the story of this fellow not knowing what had happened to him. And one of the students said, "I know that man," because I was in the Midwest, and he was from the Midwest. He said, "I know that man. He was in our church." And he told me about him. He said he was one of the leading stars of the American opera world. And on this piece of paper, he had scribbled in angry handwriting, "I'm mad, I'm damn mad that my sexuality is driving me into paganism." He'd understood something. So I said to this young student, "Well, what happened to him?" He said, "Well, after that lecture, he gave up his career. He left an incredible career in American opera. He took a job overseeing an old people's home." And I said to the student, "Does he ever sing anymore?" He said, "You should hear him sing in church." He found the Lord. Well, this is what we can hope for, but I think it would have been nice to be able to give you the second part of my lecture, but I'm sure Rick will do this for me. But the second part of the lecture actually is, what is a biblical cosmology of twoism? How does that work itself out? And just so that you can be sure that this term twoism is not an imposition on Scripture, I would argue with you that it is the essence of the biblical doctrine of holiness. Holiness. What does holiness mean? It doesn't mean necessarily something that is moral, but rather what God intends to be separated, set apart. It's set apartness. That's why God is holy. He's obviously moral, but he's holy because he's other than us. Jesus says, when you pray, pray, "Our Father who is in heaven, holy is your name." His name is holy because he's from somewhere else. And so the Sabbath is holy because it's distinct from all the other days in the week. The utensils on the table in the temple are holy. It's not because they're upstanding moral utensils. It's because they've been given a special function. This, you see, is how God creates the world. He creates the world making matter holy. That is to say, by making distinctions. You look at Genesis 1, and right the way through it, God is separating things, he's not joining the opposites, he's making distinctions. He's separating day and night and land and water, and he's making things according to the specific kinds. There's an intentionality, you see, for God to take what's true about him and us in the general terms and reflecting that in the way the creation is established. God, of course, in himself is holy in the Trinity, because the Trinity is three persons, always distinct and yet joined in one. That's the definition of twoism. I know I'm messing you up with two and three and all, but the Trinity is a twoist structure. And that's why it seems to me that when God says he creates man, male and female, in his own image, that the image that we are to receive and testify to is God, the Trinity. So, if the world is fundamentally intended for holiness in the sense of things having their special places, and at the end of creation God creates man, male and female, destined for that unity in marriage in Genesis 2:24, then you see our calling is the good news that we must present to this world of oneism, the beauty of twoism. Twoism is the key to the cosmos. Without it, you can't make sense. You can't make sense of God. You can't make sense of rationality. You can't make sense of morality. We depend upon the notion of twoism. Our computers are based on a binary system, right? It's the binary. And so our worldview is worthy of defending, worthy of preaching, worthy of actually embodying in our way of living, and especially in our relationship with the opposite sex and in marriage. I hope I've just opened the flap here for a way of approaching this issue that can be useful in the days ahead. Thank you.